Session number 2346, Mr. Arthur Glanfield, reels 7 and 8. Left channel informants mic only, right channel interviewers mic only.
Mr. Glanfield, reel 7. We're talking about when you'd established this position, this radar position, at Odeur on October 44 that time. How did you solve this problem of getting your rations? So where did you get your rations from?
Well, as far as the men were concerned, I managed to persuade the Americans where their nearest unit was, some distance away, probably 3 or 4 miles away, but arrange for them to be taken there and have their food with the Americans. That was quite satisfactory, I understand.
What about yourself?
And I chose the biggest farm near the radar station, got a landline put to that farm, to my room, so I was on call all the time during the night, and I went to a small village for my meals, where I had the meals with 4 American sergeants who were Polish Americans and spoke the language which these Russians spoke, or at least understood them. And that was satisfactory. It was in the Burgomaster's house in this village, and I understand the Burgomaster had been done away with in some way, and it was only his cook and housekeeper there who provided us with American food, which was very satisfactory.
Now, when you were operational, so you were tracking the V1s, that's what,
yeah.
Was there much to do?
Oh yes, it was going on all the time, I imagine about every 15 minutes or 30 minutes.
So what exactly would you do when one was trying?
As soon as one was on the screen, the moment it had been launched, because they never changed the launching pad, or only from 100 yards or something, and the radar only offered in a very narrow band, that's all was necessary. Because we didn't expect any V1s from any other region. And it was the same as Beachy Head,
the golf course.
The golf course in near Hastings there. As soon as one was tracked within seconds, certainly not more than 10 seconds, the authorities in Brussels and Antwerp were informed. Another V1 on the way.
What would they do? Do you see what I mean? What was the point of them knowing? What could they do?
Well, their activities, I imagine, I never questioned them, but I imagine in Brussels they sounded the siren at the appropriate time, knowing that there was a V1 due in their area within 20 minutes, and in Antwerp, whatever work was going on in the docks, they did something, whatever they needed to do there.
You wouldn't be able to launch any countermeasures, get any interception or shooting down?
I don't know about that. I wasn't concerned with that at all. I was not in touch with any anti-aircraft at all.
And what about V2s?
V2s, I'd heard of, but there is no means of tracking them with that type of radar.
So what happened? You'd set up this position. What happened next?
Well, we were there. Let's see. For several weeks. I can't remember exactly how long, but we were there for quite a time. I went back to Brussels during the day occasionally, when things seemed quite static, on my motorbike, and. The roads were quite dangerous because, particularly in the American sector, The vehicles were very big, and a motorbike was very small and considered better off the road as far as they were concerned. And most of the trucks were driven by coloured soldiers who were probably not as careful as the others. But anyway, I went back a number of times. The farmer was very, very friendly. I was given a good room, and they showed me photographs which they had managed to take and keep of a Canadian Air Force crew that had sheltered with them for a few hours, having crashed in the area during the war. But they're very, very friendly indeed. And eventually, unknown to me, whether it was because of the German activity in the Ardennes, or what it was, but I imagine that that's what it was, that the Germans had launched their attack, and I was instructed to get back as quickly as possible with the radar.
Back to Brussels?
Back to my unit at wherever they were. They had moved then to another place quite near to where they were, called Vertrek, V-E-R-T-R-E-C-K, I think it is. It's a chateau there.
What happened there? That would be December 44.
Yeah.
Anything happened at Vertrek?
Well, there we were not actually active, at least I wasn't, with the radar. I was doing mostly either work in the plotting room, the mobile plotting room, which by then had more or less become static, or going every day to the command operation room in a large Air Force unit, aerodrome rather, which was not too far away from Louvain.
And what were you visiting? What would you do when you visited the RAF?
I would sit in the operation room and be in communication constantly with our operations room, our mobile operations room, and give them any information that I thought would be useful to them to put on their plotting board.
So it was a liaison job?
I was a liaison officer, yes. It was interesting that around this aerodrome, which was operational, there were a lot of large four-engined American bombers all round this aerodrome, which had flown from America, but they had never taken part in any operations. They were just grounded. But on the aerodrome itself, there were the operations were mostly with, nearly all, with fighter bombers and fighter planes. Some of them carried belly tanks to take them further into Germany, but they were comparatively small planes. But it was interesting listening to their intercom over Germany to the to the aerodrome, to the control tower. And there were no German raids of any sort by then. And things have become fairly static. The only operation I remember was I was on duty, and that must have been, we did a duty also at the Brussels operations room, the mobile. We had an operations room there in Brussels, or rather at the aerodrome just outside Brussels, and I was on duty on the 1st of January 1945, and early in the morning, and somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning. There weren't any plots on the board, but no hostile plots anyway. And I remember there was a big noise of damage in the roof, and it appears that a German low-flying plane had fired some machine gun or small shells at this aerodrome where we were on the edge of. And that's about the only operation at that time I remember.
They were very quiet.
Yes.
Nothing much to that, as far as you were concerned. You were...
No. No, and while we were there, I remember the time when the Rhine was crossed, or I think it was the Rhine that was crossed. We were still in this place, Wörthrecht, and it was a Saturday morning where we knew the day before that the operation was to take place, and I remember having to go out personally and get a signature from the battery commanders of the guns that under no circumstances on that next day, which was a Saturday, would any gun be operational in view of the friendly aircraft.
The risk of shooting down Allied aircraft.
Yeah. So that was, I remember. And then on the Saturday morning, which was a very fine sunny morning, in the middle of the morning we saw these aircraft towing either one or two gliders, some of them immediately overhead in the direction of Germany. It took about probably at least an hour for the whole lot to pass over, and of course there was a loud cheer from the village people. And that was that. And that must have been probably the end of March or something. Very shortly after that, as soon as the Rhine had been crossed, we were given our move, our next move. And that was to move away from Belgium through Holland, to the Rhine, to the west side of the Rhine, that is, and we had to camp as best we could near the Rhine, a place called Xanten, X-A-N-T-E-N, I think, Xanten. And there again, we were not provided with accommodation. We were accommodated as best we could in tents and anything.
Was this the whole unit or just the radar?
Oh, the whole unit.
And what happened at Xanten?
We didn't We didn't set up an operations room then. Well, we did set up an operation room, but we weren't fully operational because it wasn't necessary, apparently. And we were, I thought, held in readiness for a move across the Rhine or whatever we were instructed to do. But it so happens that that order never came. We were never crossed the Rhine. We would not be there very long, but there was no comfort whatsoever provided by anybody, and what Germans we saw, they kept well away from us, and if anything was required, as I spoke a few words of German, such as I needed some of the officers' clothes to be laundered or something, they did without any problem. I always took the driver, the OC's driver, and went in his jeep, and gave them a tablet of soap, and told them that I'd be back the next day, and it was all ready, no problem. But most of that was not done just by the Rhine. It was done in the surrounding small woods and forests, where there were a number of people still occupying their premises undamaged. But Zanten itself was completely destroyed, near enough. I did get other duties to do, I remember.
What were they?
Well, one other duty in particular. The brigadier asked me to take a 3-ton vehicle and go to an American unit near Dusseldorf on the west side of the Rhine, and get an allocation of officers' spirits and similar drink as authorized by him with the Americans. It took a day to do it, and there was no problem. Things like that. It was merely domestic problems, not operational problems. We were merely waiting for something which eventually came, of course, the end of the war.
So fundamentally, your unit wasn't necessary, really, I mean, in many ways. Other than watching out for V1s, it had a fairly minimal role once you'd actually got out there.
Yes, we really had been in reserve for the operation unit that I never met them, but they were very close to where the fighting was. Within 10 miles, I would say.
So you stayed at Zanten till May?
Yes, we were there the day that the war ended.
Now, what do you remember of V-Day? Were there any celebrations for you?
Yes, I believe one of the units of the brigade, I'm not sure which unit, because I was not in contact with the guns, but one of the units had been chosen to fire the victory salvo on the Rhine. And we were in some improvised huts on a form of allotment when the salvo was fired sometime in the middle of the day, I think. And I do remember we all came out of our improvised shelters a few minutes before it happened, and there was a very old man tending to some potatoes in this plot, which was sort of an allotment, and he didn't know anything about this, and he was not only surprised, we watched him and wondered what he would do, and he just collapsed and fell on the ground. He never knew what had happened. There was the unit celebrated that night, of course, and
what do you remember of the celebration?
They had a huge bonfire, they did something which was not approved of. They burnt a piano on the fire, I remember, which belonged to the brigade had commandeered somewhere, the authorities in the brigade headquarters were not pleased with. And I went round in a jeep, round the small place, Zampton, and the signals officer was younger than me, and he was a very enthusiastic man, and he insisted on getting some ammunition and firing off his revolver in the village at all the houses that he passed, which of course were probably unoccupied.
Did you get drunk yourself, or...?
No. The OC of my unit, Major Crisp, had instructed me on that day, D-Day, to go back to Brussels with a fairly big truck, and he'd give me the name of a big brewer there in Brussels, and he had the unit's money, the entire unit money, which he said he intended to use to buy beer in barrels for the men to enjoy themselves as long as it lasted. It lasted 3 days, I think. I took a day to get there and a day to get back. I did a lot of things. I was I looked after the officers' requirements as far as the officers' mess was concerned.
Were you the president of the mess then? Or
yes.
What did it entail? Tell us a bit.
Well, it entailed making sure that the officers were fed as well as they could be, and the cooks and batmen and so on, that they performed to the officers' requirement. And everywhere I went, that's why at this farm in France, I tried to find better accommodation and better food for the officers. Although I failed there. So that was the end of the war. And after the... about shortly after the festivities and the beer had all been consumed, we had orders to go back to Belgium as a unit.
Where to?
It was between Ghent and Brussels, near Ghent, a place called Massamem. I think it's spelled Massemem, something like that, near Wetteren, which is a bigger place. It was a chateau there, and it was big enough to accommodate the whole unit. And that was satisfactory. There were no occupants of the chateau. It had been unoccupied, but we occupied it, and we were there several weeks while the unit was disbanded. And all our equipment was taken to an ordnance depot there. I'm not sure exactly where it was, but everything was handed in. Anything of value, the troops would hand all their weapons in, stopwatches, any equipment that was that we had. And
what happened to the personnel?
The personnel. Well, they were free to while we were there. We were there probably. At least 3 weeks, I think.
Through most of.
And just go to a holding unit, as far as the troops were concerned. I went to an officer's holding unit, which was at a place called Lier, which is halfway between Antwerp and Brussels. L-I-E-R. L-I-E-R-R-E, something like that. Lier. Quite a big place. There was a big barracks there.
And that would be June you went there?
Yes, it would be sometime in June, yes. Probably middle of June.
So what exactly was happening there in the officers holding you? Nothing much, I presume?
No, we were just free to hang around, to be away for the day, whatever, and await until we were asked to report somewhere. I myself actually had in mind of getting a job at such as secretary of the officers' club in Antwerp. That was a job I made inquiries about, and I actually went to Antwerp, but found when I got there that the job had already been filled.